Hello and welcome to the MDS Podcast, the official podcast of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society. I'm your host, Sarah Schaefer from the Yale School of Medicine and the deputy editor of this podcast. And today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Jackie Martindale, who's a pediatric movement disorders neurologist and assistant professor of pediatric neurology at Wake Forest University. And we are going to be talking today in honor of World Movement Disorders Day on November 29th, 2024, about stigma, particularly in children with movement disorders and tics and Tourette syndrome. So thank you for joining us today, Jackie.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
All right. You know, in anticipation of this podcast, I read your excellent scoping review, Reframing Stigma in Tourette Syndrome, which was published in the European Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Journal last year. I wonder if we can start by us hearing what your definition of stigma is.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. So I think stigma is a really challenging concept. And stigma itself refers to the negative labeling of someone. And in the article and in general, I talk a lot about stigmatization, which is like the actual act of labeling or setting someone aside or linking them to a negative stereotype or undesirable characteristics. The thought is that when someone is negatively labeled, they're seen as different. And then there becomes this justification of us versus them. And people feel justified in treating someone else differently because of that. And what I talk about a lot in the article, and as well as when I do these types of talks, is that stigma is so much broader than just bullying, which is what most people think about. We look at it on this social ecological model, which takes into account all these different layers of stigma. So we think about the individual level, which is really how the individual's thoughts, fears, perceptions, and what stigma includes at that level, including how they see themselves. And then there's the interpersonal level, which is where bullying lies. This is really how individuals interact with others in their environment. So including their peers, their teachers, their family, but also their social environment. There's the community level, which encompasses organizational or community environments, such as accessibility or availability of services, education or healthcare. And then lastly, we think about the structural level, which is the broader policies, laws, practices. And this is where socioeconomic factors will be included, or things like resource allocation, national institutes, desires to fund organizations or research and things like that.
I thought it was so helpful to think about it in this continuum all the way from the self up to the entire broader ecological landscape that one is in as a patient with a movement disorder. We've talked in some other episodes for World Movement Disorders Day with folks about stigma as it relates to adults with movement disorders. Is or should stigma be thought of differently in the pediatric population? And specifically related to tics, are there elements that are unique to kids that need to be considered in the conversation?
Yeah, so obviously stigma impacts individuals at all ages, but when you're thinking about pediatrics or youth in particular, there are these unique periods of development that we have to account for. And so periods like adolescence, which are really impacting how individuals see themselves and impact their well-being. And this is a tough time for all individuals, right? You're figuring out yourself, your body, your emotions, this complex social system, and then you add in difficulties like tic disorders or other movement disorders, and it really makes it more challenging. And specifically for tics, they're really unique because they're both visible and audible to others. And so it makes them really noticeable, and that makes it easy to negatively label or perceive them as different. And people just don't understand tics. And so when they have these movements or their sounds are often mislabeled as like behavioral or intentional. And that really impacts their ability to make friends, how they interact with others, including school, like how their ability to do school or interact with school and their teachers. And so you can imagine just how that impacts their kind of overall mental health and their well-being. We also know, just thinking about brain development in general, that early life stressors can alter brain structure and function through like epigenetic changes. And so you can only imagine that when you have groups of individuals who are more at risk for stressors, that also impacts their brain structure and function. Now, studies haven't specifically been done in Tourette syndrome, but it's hard to imagine that the same wouldn't be true, and that can impact their overall outcomes.
Now, you mentioned the relationship that a child might have in the classroom with a teacher. Obviously, children have different support systems in place than adult patients do. Instead of care partners, they have parents, teachers, coaches, other adult family members. How do these adults in the room impact stigma for these patients, for pediatric patients?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, the other people in the room are often more of the problem. I think it's true for all ages, but I've had so many people, both in the clinical setting and the research setting, talk about how their tics don't necessarily bother them individually. And granted, that's not true for everyone, but it's more how others interact with them and how others see their tics. And a prime example is if you have an eye-rolling tic, a lot of people will perceive that as being rude or disrespectful, and they don't take the time to ask what that is or why you're doing that and how you do that. It can really impact how they see themselves and their desire to interact with others. There's not a lot of disorders out there that we treat because of how it impacts others, but I think these visible disorders like tic disorders and Tourette syndrome, that is often a big driver because of the social impact. And so it's really interesting to think about. And a lot of this stems from lack of awareness or these misconceptions about tic disorders and Tourette syndrome. The other thing I want to say is that how the adults in the room are impacted is there's also courtesy stigma. So these parents or caregivers will often be negatively labeled just from their association with the individual with the affected disorder. Another example is parents or caregivers might be judged as that the tics are a result of their parenting style or their discipline style. And that can lead to affiliate stigma, which is then how they start to negatively think about themselves because of that interaction. And so it can impact not only the affected individual, but those around them.
Wow, so many layers to think about. You mentioned that people with tics and with movement disorders in general are at particular risk of stigma because of their audible or visible nature. And also you mentioned some misconceptions about tics. I just want to delve into that a little bit more. What other aspects of tic disorders make them at particular risk of stigma? For example, how tics are portrayed in the media.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, tics are audible and visible. So it makes them really easy to notice and identify. And people will immediately perceive that as different or something that's out of the ordinary. And so unlike other visible disorders, though, tic disorders are often compared negatively. And so I think that is one layer of how tic disorders put people at risk for stigma. But that also probably stems from a lot of the misconceptions, and that comes from the media. And when people hear the word Tourette syndrome, the first thing they immediately think about is somebody shouting obscenities, which is coprolalia. And that, honestly, in reality, it only happens in about 10% of the tic disorder and Tourette syndrome population, but that's what most people associate Tourette syndrome with, and that is because that is how it's portrayed in the media. And the media has a really negatively skewed view of most disorders in general, but including tic disorders and Tourette syndrome. And that really impacts what people think of disorders, how they view disorders, and then how they treat those individuals with that disorders. It can also impact really what they think causes the disorder, which also impacts their behavior. And I think those two things, both the audible and visible nature, and then the misconceptions, are two big areas that put these individuals at risk.
And we've talked a lot about various angles of thinking about stigma in childhood movement disorders. What else do we know about this? And also, what do we know about the potential consequences for these individuals?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Stigma impacts many movement disorders across the lifespan, and there's a growing body of research looking at stigma in this these disorders, I think for a long time we've assumed that it's there, but we really haven't understood how it impacts these individuals. And that broader aspect of stigma is so much more than just bullying or the label of the disorder. And so we know stigma in general can really impact individuals' quality of life, how they view themselves, which impacts their mental health, their well-being. It can also impact their ability or their desire to manage stressor and also their risk of suicidality. And so those are really important things. And because of that, it's also really important to screen for that stuff and that broader impact of stigma in medical care. We need to be asking how these disorders impact them on a day-to-day life, their ability to go to school, their ability to go to work, or just within their daily routines, because too often these things get missed because we're not asking. And so they're missed opportunities to provide better care, to offer resources, or to connect them with support groups that could really make a difference in their day-to-day lives.
I'll add that I think everybody listening should read your paper, because there were some surprises in there talking about how tics can impact somebody's ability to get a driver's license, for example, which is something that I had never considered before, and mostly how that's likely related to the person giving the driving test just not understanding the disease and having misconceptions about it.
Yeah, and that's true in multiple areas. And so driver's license are just one example, but there's also the physical aspect of it. So even individuals with tic disorders will come to me with questions on how it impacts their ability or if it impacts their ability to get a driver's license, thinking about the physicality of what kind of tics they have and whether that will impair their awareness. So we have those conversations. There are things like occupational therapy evaluations that can make sure that they have a safe driving environment, because we want these individuals to do everything that they want to do. But on the other side, there's all these bureaucratic processes about having to prove they have a tic disorder, or not necessarily in the United States, but in some other countries, we've also seen like just not being able to get a driver's license or even be able to do driver's test. And I'm sure that happens here too, because they perceive the individual with the tic disorder as incapable. And so they've already made the judgment before they've even taken the test.
Well, we've talked a lot about the reasons for stigma, the effects of stigma. How about combating stigma? Based on your work or work that you're familiar with, what are the most effective ways to combat stigma?
Yeah, so I think combating stigma needs to be multifaceted. If we think about on these broader levels, like structural, education and awareness are like first and foremost. And that's what a lot of these patient organizations or advocacy organizations are doing. They're trying to change people's knowledge and perceptions about disorders so that they can reduce misconceptions, which is a large part of where stigma stems from. But if you think more on the opposite end of that social ecological model, we also need to equip the individuals with the right resources. We need to set them up for success so that they can successfully interact with their environments and do the things that they need to do. We need to ask those hard things in clinic. Is there teasing? Is there bullying? Are they having trouble getting accommodations at school or work? And trying to minimize unnecessary stressors. Treatment-wise, behavioral therapies work on like coping skills and managing stressors, right? Life throws a lot of stressors at us, but with these individuals, how can they manage and face adversity despite their disorder? And I'm currently working on some research looking at promoting resilience skills in these individuals to see how it impacts some of these downstream effects like mental health and well-being, because that's not really understood within this population well.
So let's shift our focus a bit to social media. We talked about media portrayals, right? Social media is a whole nother animal, and an animal that a lot of kids are using. And I'm sure that on TikTok and things like that, there are both positive and negative portrayals. There are empowering portrayals of tics. There are misconceptions being thrown around. What is your view on the role of social media in stigma, in creating or combating stigma in Tourette syndrome and childhood movement disorders?
I feel like that's such a loaded question, and I think it has both positives and negatives. Setting aside the broader like concerns about how social media impacts youth mental health, like just in general, what is portrayed on social media can either perpetuate or mitigate misconceptions of how somebody views a disorder. So specifically with tic disorders and Tourette syndrome, what is on social media, such in these bigger platforms like TikTok or even YouTube, this really impacts how others view the disorder and what they think of the disorder. And again, that can go positively or negatively. There's a lot of individuals out there that use it as an advocacy platform, teaching others about the disorder, teaching them evidence-based facts, so that way we can mitigate those misconceptions. I also think that it provides a sense of community for some individuals, and for a lot of individuals, actually, it's a place where they can find and connect with that community. And so a lot of the support groups live on platforms like Facebook and have been a huge source of support and honestly like family and community for these individuals. And so that is the positive side to it. But like all things on social media, you need to be mindful of what you're watching and the source of where it came from. On an individual level, we also know that tic disorders are suggestible. And so watching or seeing others' tics may not be beneficial for the affected individual's well-being or daily life. And so that's something that needs to be taken into consideration when you're having these conversations with your patients.
All right. So you mentioned some of the continued work that you're doing on resiliency in tic disorders. Your scoping review identified a lot of information about stigma in tic disorders and also identified some gaps. Can you speak to the ways that you think stigma research can be advanced moving forward?
Yeah, so I think a lot of what I talk about is based off of theoretical frameworks and other populations. A lot of this work is done in individuals who identify with sexual or gender minorities or HIV or other mental health disorders. And so there's a lot of research that needs to be done specifically within tic disorders and Tourette syndrome, but also other movement disorders, really trying to understand how and why stigma impacts these individuals so that we can figure out how to modify that or change it and make their trajectory better. I'm currently working on validating a stigma scale that will more objectively measure individuals' perceptions of stigma on all these different levels. So at the individual level, interpersonal, community, and structural level, so that we can track this over time and see how it is associated with mental health, being resilience, and physical tic symptoms. With the updating scoping review, there has been a lot more out there, but a lot of it focuses on that interpersonal interaction. And so how it impacts them within the educational system or within their family life, which is very important. But I think we need to look more on an individual level and see how these are impacting the individuals that we're trying to take care of.
Exciting work in progress. All right. So final question. You have a broad audience at your disposal here on this podcast. What do you want to relay to our listeners about stigma in childhood movement disorders and tic disorders?
Yeah, so I thought long and hard about this because I think this is a really important topic and it impacts so many individuals. I would say two things. So one is err on the side of assuming something is related to a disability or a disorder. So whether it be a behavior, a sound, or a movement, you're much better off at assuming it's related to the disorder than to not. And that's a lot of times where that disconnect comes, assuming that something is intentional or behavioral or because of a drug side effect or something like that. And so if you err on the side that it's related to the disorder, I think it's not always perfect, but you're much better off in doing that. And then secondly, I would say that people with disorders and disabilities are people first. So regardless of what disorder or what age that we're talking about, treat people with kindness and compassion and the benefit of doubt. Your actions and words matter. Our actions, my actions and words matter. And it really impacts how these individuals think of themselves and how others think of these disorders.
Wise words. Thank you very much for this enlightening conversation, Jackie. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this opportunity.
The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society or their affiliated journals, Movement Disorders, and Movement Disorders Clinical Practice. Any disclosures of the participants can be found within the episode description located on the MDS website.